Hello, everyone, and welcome to Searching for the Question Live. My name is David Orban, and today we are here with a good friend, Brian Mello. I met Brian the first time in 2010. You may remember. It was at a conference that I organized together with Alex Lightman at Harvard University, the H Plus Summit. Dan Brown, in his book Inferno, labeled it the largest gathering of transhumanists ever. And it is funny how these things go, because I have no hesitation calling Brian a friend, and I have no hesitation saying we met the first time in 2010, which is now 14 years ago. But it turns out we haven't not only not met since, that was the first and only time, but we haven't even spoken. So, Brian, welcome. Is it an abuse of the term to call you a friend?
Yes, I'm offended. No, David, I feel the same. And that's, you know, it is remarkable that way. But my career is like this. I've been a comedian for a few decades, and sometimes you do a show or possibly several shows, several days of shows with someone, and you really connect well, and you might exchange contact info. Some of those people become like friends that you, some of them you never see again, you never cross paths with, but I would still, I was going to say the same, like, and I kind of balked at it. I was like, I'm going to do this thing with a friend of mine, and it's like, is he a friend of mine? I haven't spoken to him in 14 years. But yeah, I consider you a friend.
Thank you.
So we
Thank
see
you.
Each other. We appear in each other's notifications. And that's what friendship is in 2024.
that is I think, very interesting. And to be part of the very positive stream of consciousness, like of notifications and things that someone posts, someone else comments on. We are living our digital lives, and we feel that to be such a close part of what we are today, that the fact that we haven't been in physical proximity and we haven't nurtured our friendship in a traditional manner, it doesn't feel like it is missing something.
And
of course,
and you know, there's
a lot
always
of people
a possibility.
Could disagree.
Yeah. And there's always, hey, you can always invite me to your next conference.
I will be happy to. Absolutely.
Someday we'll end up in the same room together again.
So let's start from the beginning. When you were in kindergarten, and people asked you, what do you want to do when you grow up? You replied, I want to be a science comedian, right?
Not at all. Comedian, definitely not. The science did come first. I can actually tell you, I don't know about kindergarten, but I do have some old papers I wrote in about second grade. And there is one about wanting to be an astronaut. And I wish I could completely, I think it's somewhere on my Instagram channel, which is at Science Comedian. But I, from a fairly early age, I fell in love with science and also with music. And one of my best friends had the same passions. And so through junior high and high school, we wrote songs together, mostly my lyrics to his music. We wanted to be rock stars, but we also kind of wanted to be scientists. So like kind of Buckaroo Banzai, without even knowing who that was. I think we had this, those were our passions. And we didn't end up pursuing the music far enough. But I also was falling in love with comedy through Monty Python and George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Steve Martin, the original Saturday Night Live crew. And I was too shy actually to That doesn't really make sense, because I imagined being a rock star and being Freddie Mercury standing on my bed in my bedroom, being a rock star. So it wasn't that, but I did start falling in love with comedy, but I didn't have the nerve to try it until there's some, yeah, little Queen and Brian May stuff right there that you can
We
see.
will definitely explain what that is, because you just mentioned the Queen, and there they are.
And yeah,
so this is your Instagram, and the people who are following are welcome to follow you. So what was the discovery, the self-discovery of actually being funny?
Well, that's an interesting one. I guess pretty early on, my sister was probably my best audience, and I could, you know, make her laugh so that milk came out of her nose at the dinner table. You know, it's so hard. I don't know. I don't know where that really started. I think that even though I was shy and I wasn't the class clown, I wasn't, you know, gregarious enough to be the class clown, but amongst my friends, I was smart and funny. And I also want to say that early on, in terms of early influences that I think really influenced, like, there's all sorts of stuff I liked, but I think stuff that had the biggest influence on my sensibilities, maybe like George Carlin, really resonated with the way I think. And he would have serious stuff and goofy stuff. He could tell fart jokes right after he told really astute social commentary and some science geeky stuff. But I was reading science fiction at a pretty early age. And the kind of science fiction I liked was the hard science fiction, which is a term for a genre for people that don't know. And it just means it's the science fiction where the science matters. It's important to the plot, and the science accuracy is important. And that's not true for all science, that's not true for all good science fiction. But the stuff I grew up on, Isaac Asimov, especially, Arthur C. Clarke, Larry Niven, they wrote this very thrilling science fiction. And what was thrilling were the science ideas, not just the stories, but the science ideas were exciting. And then turns out Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke wrote a lot of science fact. And so my old friend Chuck, my songwriting partner, we started learning physics from Isaac Asimov and other sciences, as well as in school. But we were learning things in our extracurricular reading just by and Asimov had such a rational mind and wrote with such clarity and could take you to a really complex place and not lose you. And I like to think those are influences on me.
Now, if we were to draw the Venn diagram,
yes,
of people who enjoy nerdy science and people who go to comedy clubs, we find your target audience. And you know, it is perfectly fine. Kevin Kelly talks about 1,000 true fans. So it doesn't matter whether that overlapping circle defines 1 billion people or 1,000 people. However, I wonder, were you cracking jokes at science meetings first, or were you cracking science at comedy clubs? Because both of those venues would be surprised by the incongruity of your attempt, but in some way you were able to unite the crossover.
Yeah, well, in this case, so in my life, the science came first, and it was a long. It wasn't until graduate school that I got on stage for the first time. But in terms of what you just asked, I started in comedy clubs. I'm not a scientist. So I'm a comedian. A lot of times people go, what is a science comedian? Well, you know what a political comedian is. And they aren't necessarily, they're not politicians. They're just comedians with an emphasis on politics. So science comedian. I'm not a scientist. I'm a huge science enthusiast. And so I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and I was pre-med, maybe to please my Jewish parents more than that wasn't. I really am most attracted to physics and astronomy, but I like all the sciences. And it's like, okay, you know, I want to be a rock star. My parents want me to get that degree and try to become a doctor. I chose not to go to medical school, and I ended up going to graduate school in television production. And it was during graduate school that I tried comedy for the first time. And so then I left video production behind. And I say this because all of these threads in my life ultimately come together in my current career. And I think about, if you've ever seen that commencement speech by Steve Jobs at Stanford, it's just a 20-minute speech, I think. And he says a few really interesting things. And one is about how, like, I'm not mystical at all or new agey, but he says this thing about how sometimes when you look back at your life, you see how these things came together. It was unpredictable. Who could have imagined that I would use my science knowledge as a comedian? You know, that wasn't predictable. So what happened, I started doing my comedy in comedy clubs. But from the beginning, it was geeky. It was informed by my love of science and science fiction. So I was doing comedy clubs and I was being pretty geeky. Some jokes were too geeky. They were so geeky that you probably didn't tell them very often because you want to get booked back to the club. You want to, and that, but occasionally if I had a critical mass of science people in the audience, like maybe you find out a bunch of these people are from some sort of science organization, then I could pull out my geekiest material and it would work so beautifully. So it was starting in comedy clubs, playing around with this geeky humor. It took me a long time to come up with the phrase science comedian. And I was far into my comedy career. And I realized, so I didn't set out to become a science comedian. I realized that phrase described what I had been doing for years already. And I like to humorously say sometimes that I checked, and this would have been 12 or 15 years ago, I checked and sciencecomedian.com was available, which is either a really good sign or a really bad sign, like it's useless real estate. But it turned out to be great because, first of all, once I had that label for it, things crystallized around it. It's like, oh, if I cut a few things away, most of what I do, even if it's not all educational, it could be, it's science comedy. And that's like, oh, now I understand. So things crystallized around that phrase. And then also having the website, and that's my handle on most social media, it helps. It turns out occasionally people search for a science comedian and they're probably going to find me.
That's very interesting. And I also pulled up the Steve Jobs video that everyone can easily find on YouTube, and it is really inspiring.
And it's only 15 minutes long.
It is just amazing.
It has a few ideas in it, and it's really inspirational. And that, looking back, so here I am, and when I look back now, I am a comedian. So right, I've always been a writer and creator, whether it was song lyrics or short stories, and there was always the humor there. The humor was always there. So here I am now. I brought back, I had these video skills. I put them on hold to become a comedian. But years later, I had an opportunity to make science videos for Time Magazine. And I also, it sounds cocky or weird or funny to say this, but I had a pretty pioneering live streaming talk show in 1999 and 2000. And wow. It was because I was part of a network based in San Francisco, based closer to Sacramento, actually, but I was living in San Francisco. A company called Play Incorporated, they had broken off from NewTek, which had created the video Toaster, and way before
I
YouTube.
I had an Amiga, so all right, I know those things.
Yeah, so you know what happened? It's my understanding that they had created this software for the Amiga, and some of the people in the company were like, hey, PCs are becoming popular. We need to write this for the PC. And I think maybe this is my perhaps faulty memory, that some of the people in the company didn't want to do it. So some of them broke off and formed NewTek, and they created this device for the that would interface with a PC. And this is so in 99, way before YouTube and way before podcasting, they ended up creating a network with 6 live streaming video shows. And we were sending out 2 streams. One was a 56K dial-up stream, and one was a 300K for DSL or cable modems. And so, and it had a kind of green screen thing, and I could have guests, and I could control it with keyboard shortcuts. I could cut between your camera and mine, and I had graphics and lower thirds. So I did 300 episodes. In a year and a half, I did 300 episodes of a live talk show, and I interviewed hundreds of scientists, authors, comedians.
Is any of that material available in archives?
It's not. Some of it would be interesting still to share, and I have it now digitized. The quality, it was archived on SVHS, and it was, you know, we're talking video tech from 1999 and 2000. So there's some bits, but I interviewed William Gibson. He was one of my favorite interviews, and Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club.
There you go. Listen, don't underestimate the curiosity and the eagerness for people who you may not be aware of to get their hands on that material.
Yeah.
A similar example, I was in the house of Richard Saul Wurman, who originally founded the TED conference series before it was taken over by the current management. And similarly, that was born before everything was natively digital already. So we are chatting about whatever, and my eyes fall on the cardboard box on the floor in the room, and my heartbeat just stops. It's full of analog tapes. And in a marker on the box is TED, the early years. And so I asked Richard, is it what it is, what I see? And he says, yes. And are those conference materials digitized yet? No.
Hmm.
And there are incredible things, Steve Jobs saying things that no one has had the opportunity to hear, unless they were in the late 80s in the conference and in Monterey or wherever it was, right?
Yeah.
So I would encourage you to find a way to put that material online, because it will find some enthusiastic audience.
You know, it's funny you would even say that, because one clip, there were some really interesting authors I interviewed, and William Gibson, for those who don't know, is a science fiction author that I adore. And in 99 or 2000, eBay must have been fairly new, because I remember I did used to have a clip online a million years ago, and it was him talking about how interesting eBay is and how it's cleaning up the world's attics. And it's like you could find take something. I mean, just imagine, this is when eBay was kind of new, and he was like marveling at the fact that you might have something that only one person in the world would be interested in, but that one person could find it. And then he gave a couple examples, and it was just like, it's so interesting to hear someone talk about anything that new, like the TED Talks, when it was in its infancy, and you hear a perspective before something becomes so cliche and so big a part of our lives, like the internet itself or something.
So as I was sharing your Instagram feed, we couldn't but marvel on the photos of you together with some original members of the Queen.
Yeah.
So what's the deal here?
Well, that one, the one in the upper right corner, I just want to comment on because I really love that I saw this. I, and this is relevant to the whole Brian May thing, is that in the, not that one, but the Freddie Mercury one. And I will explain, that's a 3D photo. That's a stereo pair. Now this, I'm a hobbyist photographer, and the two things I've done a lot of are insect photography, macro photography. I saw this flower in my yard at my house here several years ago, and I immediately anthropomorphized it, and I immediately thought of Freddie Mercury, and I just put those two images together because I saw this. It's like, oh, it just, and I was always a big Queen fan. So when I was growing up, they've always been my favorite band, and I had posters of them on my wall. There is no way, again, this was not foreseeable at all. Brian May, it turns out, guitarist for Queen. If you don't know, all the guys in Queen were smart and college educated. Brian May was studying astronomy and astrophysics. And but in fact, to this degree, he even had at least one co-authored paper in Nature before Queen hit. And then Queen in 1973 is their first album, and he gets busy for like 30 years. But at the age of 59, he went ahead and completed his PhD. So he's Dr. Brian May with a PhD in astrophysics. And then this past year he was knighted, so he's Sir Dr. Brian May. And if people in England all know, he's a big animal rights activist, and he's on television a lot, ranting about some issues that are close to his heart. Well, he's such a Renaissance man. Since childhood, he's been really obsessed with 3D photography, stereo photography. And he especially likes the old Victorian stuff. So if you don't know, you know these old Victorian stereoscopes, which when photography came out, 3D photography came out immediately, because the concept for it, a guy came up with this idea even before photography. The fact that we see in 3D is dependent on the fact that we have two eyes. Two eyes, two different perspectives. If you only have one eye, you do not actually see in 3D. There are visual cues that tell you something is farther away or closer.
There are many components to 3D vision.
Yeah.
So with one eye, you lose a lot of those components. Yeah. But for example, the fact that you focus at a certain depth in your visual field remains. The stereoscopic images that we were showing, and then you will be giving us more detail about, rely on the parallax effect. And when I was a child, and you and everyone, we would be playing with the fact that as we close one eye and hold something close to our nose, the place where it appears in our visual field dramatically changes. And that is just astonishing, or at least it was to me.
It is. And then our brains take these two different vantage points, and in our heads, we get this three-dimensional world. But interestingly, I mean, a little of an aside, but it's also part of the 3D experience that I love, is with eyes this far apart, we really only have that kind of true depth perception out about 30 feet, I think it is. Because after that, these are really no longer two different angles. You know, if you get so far away, so there's an importance of a ratio. If you take pictures if you had eyes farther apart, you would have depth out farther. And the extreme of that would be something astronomers have done. When the Earth is in one position in its orbit around the sun, if you take some images out that direction, and then wait 6 months for the Earth to be on the opposite side of the sun, then you have a baseline. Instead of this couple inches apart, the sun is 93 million miles away. So 186 million miles apart, you have two eyes looking out in space. And that's actually a big enough baseline that they've been able to see depth in only the very closest stars, because the others are still too far away for that to even be significant. So,
and another example of a baseline that is wider than ours, and it plays an important role, is in the fantastic hard sci-fi novel by Werner Vinge, Fire Upon the Deep.
I love that book. I don't remember what you're talking about, but I love that book.
It is the species of alien creatures that we interpret as if they were kind of wolves or similar to wolves.
Right.
That are pack intelligences.
Yes.
If they are five, they are optimally intelligent. If it is more than five in the pack, their thoughts start to be too cacophonic. And if they are three or less, they are just too dumb and idiotic. They cannot function at the high level. But when they hunt, since they are telepathic, they spread out, and they are able to see through the senses and the eyes of the various members of the pack at a very wide baseline.
Yeah, that's excellent. And without going into, too deep a lesson on this, but if you check out my Science Comedian Instagram page, you'll often see two photos together. So for some people that remember those magic eye posters, that they don't look like they have, they just look like patterns, but by a trick of the eye, you can create a 3D image. And the trick is to stare past the plane of the image. And like this, these pictures of Brian May performing with Queen plus Adam Lambert a couple years ago, the trick is to find a position where you can look through them and focus beyond that plane and get the images to merge, and you can see him in 3D. It's helpful if you have a stereoscope, because it does the work for you. The stereoscope makes sure the right eye only sees the right eye image and the left eye only sees the left eye. When you're at a movie that's 3D, the glasses do the same thing, either because of polarized light or because blinking on and off. The trick is show one image to one eye, the other image to the other eye. But those of us, so Brian May is so into this that he resurrected the London Stereoscopic Company that existed in the 1850s. Since 2010, they've put out about 15 or more books. Some are books of pure scholarship about stereo cards that existed in the 1850s or early 1900s. And others, he finally put out one that's Queen in 3D, featuring his own photos of the band. And he always had a camera on the tour, and he would give it to photographers so they could shoot the band. And then, yeah, that's, and I have to tell you about that event right there. In 2022, so he's such an evangelist for this. There's a community. He's very personally active on Instagram. And there's a community of us. He's inspired us to get into stereophotography. And in 2022, they solicited submissions from us to put out a book that's modern stereophotographers. And probably 100 of us have photos. I have two photos in the book. It's called Stereoscopy is Good for You. You can find it on Amazon or other places. It's from the London, or directly from the London Stereoscopic Company. And just a beautiful thing. And then because of this, I got to know him a little bit. I did interview him in 2010. Wow, the same year I met you, I interviewed him when they put their first book out, the London Stereoscopic Company. And there's a clip or two on my site, and on my YouTube channel is also, there's more on YouTube, and that's also @ScienceComedian. Because I've taken some really good pictures of the band last year, and in 2022 and then again in 2023, he gave me press passes so that I could be as close as possible to the stage. And I took some really beautiful 3D photos. And only a handful are there. The photos I took actually belong to the band. So more of them will come out later, but I did post a few on his birthday a year or so ago. And yeah, so I love it. And I also enjoy taking sort of documentary style. I really enjoy taking 3D photos when I'm traveling at airports and train stations. I love seeing, especially seeing someone from some other culture in very traditional garb, but in the modern setting of an airport. I love documenting what life is like today. Gentrification in my neighborhood. I like shooting decayed things and things being replaced. And I just love, I've done so much at airports and train stations. Yeah, that's my YouTube channel.
So also got involved with a fairly prestigious science group. It is the meeting of Nobel Prize winners or something. So how come? How did that happen?
Yeah, this is another one that it's, and by the way, I want to point out that I really love everything at the intersection of science and art. And so photography is automatically science and art probably, but like I said, I love shooting insects, macro photos of insects. I have a domain that I'm not currently using, but I do have on Instagram, insect paparazzi, because I follow the insects around. I'll make you a star. Let me shoot you. Let me do your headshots. And insect photography. So insect photography and 3D photography, clearly you see how I don't plan it this way, but what I'm drawn to is that intersection of science and art. So 3D photography is totally science and art. And then especially if I shoot 3D photos of a Nobel laureate or a science lab. I've been to a couple neutrino labs and I've shot some 360 images, but I've also shot 3D photos. So yeah, so what you're talking about is something else that requires a little explanation, because it's this fantastic meeting that not many people know about. It's called the Lindau Nobel Laureate Meeting. It's been going on since 1951. And you know what? So this is separate from the Swedish organization that does the Nobel Prizes. Okay, they work with them a lot, but this is a different entity entirely. They're a nonprofit in Germany. And really, as an act of post-war reconciliation, a couple men had this idea, hey, what if we invited some scientists to this beautiful little idyllic island, Lindau, Germany? It's a little island on Lake Constance near Austria and Switzerland. And they'll bring some Nobel laureates for a meeting, and then they started bringing young scientists. And the scale of it now is they'll bring a couple dozen Nobel laureates for a week every summer, and about 600 young scientists from 80 to 100 countries. And it's all about mentorship. And it's not just that the young scientists learn science from the laureates. Each laureate gives one half-hour talk, but the meeting is about so much more. There's other kinds of interaction. They have meals together. You can ask them about work-life balance and just everything about being a scientist. And if you're a young scientist, which is defined as under 35, and the only reason for that is that it's about mentorship. So if you're not a little earlier in your career, it's about mentorship. So there are some undergrads, grad students, postdocs, PhD students, and there are three Nobel Prizes in science. So the meetings are themed. This summer, it'll be a physics meeting. The next one will be a chemistry meeting, then a medicine physiology, and it rotates. Every 3 years, maybe, they have an economics meeting that doesn't go back as far, but they do that now. And I think every 5 years, it's interdisciplinary and it's even bigger and it's all of that mixed up. And you know, there's a lot to be said for interdisciplinary. And actually every year is because a physics meeting, I naively thought that that was a specialized meeting. At first, it was quickly pointed out to me that a specialized meeting is when you go to a meeting that's just about nuclear resonance magnet. You know, it's just about something really like climate science. But this meeting that's physics, every type of physicist might be there, whether you're studying the climate or neutron stars or materials.
And your presence is important because as a science communicator, you're able to cross the chasm of the various hyper-specialized languages that would make it hard for even physicists to understand each other if someone were not there translating.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you, thank you for saying that, because that is where, when I think about my role, about what I have to offer, my relationship with them started with, I was on a panel at the AAAS conference in Washington, D.C. one year on a panel about communicating science with humor. And I was invited to perform at the opening ceremony for a week there. And then in terms of inspiration, I like telling this story because they flew me in a couple days early and they were going to fly me out the next day. But I knew about this meeting and all these amazing young scientists and Nobel laureates. I asked if I could stay in town for a couple more days. And I could, but I had to pay for that. You know, they paid all my expenses and a fee. But if I wanted to stay extra, I would have to kick in for the hotel. I decided to stay a couple extra days and pay for the hotel. And while I was there, for fun, I interviewed scientists. I walked around interviewing some of the scientists. Somebody noticed. And the result is that became my relationship with them. Every year for 8 years now, I go to the meeting and I do interviews with scientists. I've interviewed laureates, but most of what I do is I walk around with an iPhone and a selfie stick and I do live interviews right onto their social media channels. And I just, without direction, I walk around and I identify people that I think would, I just have a lot of conversations with people. And when I find someone that I think would be an interesting interview on camera, you know, someone could be an amazing scientist and they might be a tough interview. So you also want to find that combination of personality, but these are all extraordinary. It's a very selective process to get those 600 people from 100 countries. So they're all extraordinary. And I do these live interviews and it's so much fun. And yeah, I like to think I'm not a scientist, but I feel like I'm a good bridge between the scientists and the public, that I understand that if I didn't understand what you just said, the public didn't. And even if I did understand it, sometimes I know it needs to be clarified a little more for a more general audience. So I do like that role of bringing science to the public and making sure it's at the right level. And scientists don't always know what that right level is when they get so deep into their science. And you know what? I'm often asked this. You know, my interviews are not always funny. I've done a lot of interviews that are not funny because here's what I realize my priorities are. When I'm a comedian on stage, obviously humor is number one. When I'm doing an interview, my first priority is clarity. Second to that, I bring enthusiasm. I'm a very curious and enthusiastic person. I get excited about the ideas and I transmit that. Clarity, enthusiasm, and then humor. But the thing, inevitably, me being who I am, some humor gets into it, but it doesn't have to if it's clear and interesting and kind of cool.
And also with regards to your interviewees, it would be sometimes potentially uncomfortable to be put on the spot, not only to talk about what they do, but they would feel a pressure to be funny themselves. and maybe they wouldn't be able to, right? And if they were not, then it would be a more passive role of just being the subject of the jokes that you crack at potentially their expense. And I think that more and more scientists and scientific institutions realize how important it is to communicate with a larger public. And as a consequence, the role of people like you who can communicate the concepts that specialists design and record in their very formal academic publications with mathematical language that is impenetrable to most, well, your role is fundamental in this kind of outreach. I am always very happy when I see a listing for an artist in residence at CERN or NASA or other places. And it is a skill to communicate well that those scientists, and they are rare, that have the skill or develop the skill, they leverage it very well. And I think it is fantastic that they do directly. Carl Sagan, of course, is the classic example, but more contemporary examples are Brian Greene comes to my mind, or the director of the New York Observatory. What's his name? The African American gentleman.
Yeah, yeah.
Neil
deGrasse
Tyson.
It's the American. It's the American Museum of Natural History. Yeah.
And these are fantastic examples of people who are scientists and can also communicate with the kind of flair and enthusiasm that is really so wonderful
yeah.
and so important to inspire people of any age and any background to understand that the work that scientists do is extremely valuable, and it is what shaped our world. Now, let's go back to the issue of comedy and provoke you a bit with a time travel experiment. Let's go in the future and find ourselves in a time where, and this is a dystopia. I'm not saying this is what is going to happen in our world, but let's imagine a world where the current polarization of points of view makes it so that the kind of translation and communication in the various areas of online or offline conversations becomes practically impossible, and the weaponization of past histories becomes even more extreme. And let's imagine that Brian Mello is crucified online for something that he said 10 or 20 years ago that was discovered and based on the assumed necessary norms of behavior of that future point in time is unacceptable, intolerable. How do you feel as someone who must provoke and go a bit on the edge and be jesty about the way you look at things? How do you feel about that perspective?
So this is an example of what you were saying, where my interview guests might be made uncomfortable and forced to address a topic. Yes, so it's a tough issue, because when we're talking about political correctness, And you mentioned this to me before we got online about cancel culture and this stuff. You know, clearly there's a very positive side to political correctness and our evolution of in our culture of what's appropriate and inappropriate. There's one side of that that is inarguably positive. That we don't say the kinds of things, stupid racial stereotype stuff or bigoted stuff, that's no longer acceptable. But what it bounces up against is comedians who have a real nothing is sacred, and maybe, you know, most artists aspire to this, but comedians certainly aspire to this thing of nothing is sacred. It's like I can tell a joke. And in one way, it could be considered offensive, but that doesn't necessarily represent my. You hear comedians quite often say things that you cannot li take literally true. I mean, it's the most common thing. If you make some derogatory comment about the whole lot, I used to have a joke where I would say, I've started to have a
Are you sure
real.
you want to repeat it? This is your
Yeah.
chance not to repeat it.
Yeah, because I'm skirting around the heart of your subject. And so this one I can say is that I've started to have, and you know, the inspiration for it was a music video on VH1 that had Ricky Martin and Christina Aguilera and about how beautiful they were. And I was attacking their talent. I mean, they're both very, but that's just the thing. They're both very talented, obviously. I can't do anything that they did in their
Well,
career.
let me give you an example of currently perfectly and universally accepted behavior that I am guaranteeing will be seen as despicable and barbaric
Okay.
in the future, hopefully as soon as possible. And it is our eating animals. I love dogs, and I believe dogs have. Are self-conscious. You know, when I see my dog dreaming, how can I deny that it is self-conscious? And I am told pigs are as or more intelligent than dogs. I have never seen a pig dreaming, and I love pigs, and my love towards dogs is externalized by petting them. My love towards pigs is externalized by eating them. And that little joke, 10 or 20 or 50 years from now, will sound horrifying. And there will be a transition period where people will be tolerated because they cannot stop their habit and meat from animals will become more and more expensive, even though precision agriculture will deliver superior food, and we will have Michelin star preparations in our robotic kitchens based on nutrient mixes that precisely correspond to our metabolic needs, and it will be fantastic. But after that transitionary period, people will really look at us and be horrified, and we will kind of deserve their
Right.
condemnation.
But even given that, though, that would be the situation, shouldn't it still be allowable that a comedian on stage at a comedy club could make a joke like you did, and that doesn't have to mean that the comedian is evil or anything? Let me just the very simple joke I was going to give you as an example, because comedians do this sort of thing all the time, where I just said to the audience, I go, I've started to have a real negative reaction towards beautiful people. And then I go, I don't mean anyone here. And then I continue. And now clearly I don't mean that. That's part of comedy. I just I flash a smile. You know, I'm not calling everyone. It's absurd. I'm not calling everyone in here in the audience ugly. I'm just making a joke because it's kind of the wordplay. It's set up for that. Now, that doesn't represent my true feelings. I don't honestly think the audience is all ugly people. It's just a joke, and we can laugh and move on. But I have to admit that there's a fine line, because there are some kinds of jokes that it's like, I'm not easily offended, but I may lose respect for you. And so much hinges on context. First of all, the context that it's a comedy club and these are jokes. And the other part of the context is, if I think what you said is coming from a place of love or hatred, when I say that joke to the audience, it's clearly not malicious. And I smile in a way that suggests that wasn't malicious. But somebody else could say something and you're like, oh, that's not just a racist joke. I get the feeling that comedian is racist. So much hinges on that. And it's just a tough one. I mean, some people, say Dave Chappelle or something, or Louis C.K., they clearly, they don't care what people think. That won't stop them from saying the kinds of jokes they want to say. But I'm not quite out there like that. First of all, I don't think of my style of humor. It's a little more gentle than that anyway. But I guess I do think of things that I probably can't say on stage, or they don't even fit my persona. But these the thoughts we have, and it's like, it's humorous. You know, I'm Jewish, and and for the longest time, my best friend and roommate in several partners was a gay man, and I'm a Jewish man, and we could make jokes or say things that someone might go, I can't believe you said that, but Tom's not going to be, but we know that we're just playing with irony, and in fact, that's often what a joke is. That joke calling the audience ugly, the reason that's funny is because you shouldn't say that. It's impolite to say that. The fact that I did say it, it's shocking, and it crosses this, you know, line, but it's in the context of a comedy club, and you know it's a joke. But that's something about, you know, there are a lot of there theories of humor, and who knows what it's really all about. But sometimes it's surprise. You don't expect it. That it's always funny to hear little kids say rude things out loud because they don't have that filter yet. And they don't mean anything bad by it. They're just speaking. They call somebody fat or something. Look how fat that person is. And it makes you laugh a little because, oh my God, you're not supposed to say that out loud. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
These are, I think, very important topics. And one of the reasons they are important is because they represent one example of the evolution of ideas, the necessity of memetic engineering with our eyes open, where we understand the implications of complex ideas and the relationship we have with reality, where on one hand, we recognize that reality wins, but on the other hand, we are also proud, especially in science, how our ideas are actually shaping reality, because they are changing the trajectory of civilization. Brian, I want to thank you very much for the time that we spent together today. And
it went by way too quickly.
I am aware of so many other things and topics that we listed before and we didn't have the time to touch upon, but maybe sooner than another 14 years, we will gather again And we will just continue the conversation as if nothing happened, and we will have a wonderful time as we had together with our viewers today. And I apologize to Regina and to Morris and to Romina and to Dario, who have said hello, and I kind of forgot showing their comments and questions during our time
But now
together
you're
today.
apologizing at the same time that you are showing them, so there's really no need
Well,
to
there you go.
apologize.
So
Hi,
I
Regina.
am. All right,
And yeah, it was
Brian,
great to see you again. Nice to spend a little
thank
time
you.
with you, David.
Thank you very much. To the next time.